Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
This strip in Cape Town, South Africa, divides the beachside community of Strand from the township of Nomzamo. They're only a few meters apart, but the people on each side live very different lives. Strand has backyards and driveways. Nomzamo is much more dense, and the people here have fewer basic services. Less piped water, less internet access, and Nomzamo is majority black, while the area across the line is majority white. If we use dots on a map to represent race, you can see how stark that divide is. If we zoom out to the whole city, we can see it's actually everywhere. And this is the case across much of South Africa. The color of your skin here often determines where you live. It also determines your quality of life. This map shows where jobs and opportunities are primarily concentrated in Cape Town. And this is where most of the city's black people live, in informal settlements called townships on the city's periphery.
People have to move by public transport for up to 3 hours a day, and they can't take care of their obligations in the community with the rest of the family because they're always working and they're always traveling.
For decades, South Africa was under apartheid, a system that wrote segregation into law. A white minority controlled where non-white people could live, work, exist. Many were forced out of their homes. In 1994, a democratically elected government took power and ended apartheid. It was supposed to be a new beginning. But a lot of the country still looks like this. And that's because South Africa's legacy of racial division goes back centuries. In the 1600s, the Dutch took over the southern tip of Africa to supply ships with food along the trade route to Asia. 150 years later, Britain seized it and named it Cape Colony. Many Dutch colonists moved here, further inland, to escape British rule and continue exploiting enslaved people. Just like the Dutch, the British used Cape Colony as a strategic location for trade. It wasn't economically significant. But in the 1870s, that changed when the British started mining diamonds there. Suddenly, Cape Colony was one of Britain's most prized and exploited colonies. In order to get the diamonds out of the country, they built railways to connect the mines up here to the coast. The railways allowed the British to access a global diamond market through the port city of Cape Town. Soon, the economy of Cape Colony was centered around the railroads, especially this main route. The green areas on this map show the black regions of Cape Colony, largely left out of the railroad economy. Racial inequality in Cape Colony was being reinforced by location. To keep it that way, the colonial government started writing segregation into law. The Native Lands Act of 1913 pushed black people into these areas, only 8% of South Africa's land, and restricted them from owning land everywhere else, or relocated them to the edges of the major cities to work for white people. These laws began to shape the region. Cape Town's growth from the increased trade turned the port town into a major city. Many migrants from the rest of the colony and elsewhere moved here, to what was then the outskirts of Cape Town, where former enslaved people, merchants, artists, and immigrants were forming a neighborhood called District 6. As the city grew around District 6, so did the neighborhood. For decades, District 6 was a thriving, integrated community.
We were a very cosmopolitan, you could say, family almost, because there were people from all different nationalities, from all different walks of life.
This was the statement, your child is my child.
But it wouldn't last. In 1934, Britain's legal hold in what was now the Union of South Africa officially ended. The remaining white minority, the descendants of Dutch colonists, took control, and they built on the foundation the British were leaving behind. Between 1949 and 1971, the all-white government passed 148 laws solidifying apartheid.
Apartheid allowed for the full realization of the ambition of the fascist project in South Africa.
In 1950, the Population Registration Act officially classified people by race: white, colored, and native or black, and eventually Asian. Then they made laws saying where people could live. Around the country, black South Africans were moved into these areas, called homelands or Bantustans. Bantustans were rural areas and had underdeveloped economies. Many of them were in the areas Britain had already excluded from the railway economy, and where black land ownership had been restricted to. Black people were forced to carry passbooks that specified where they were allowed to work or travel to. In cities like Cape Town, the Group Areas Act moved the remaining non-whites into separate urban areas.
The most prime land and the land closest to high-valued property was allocated to white people.
In 1966, the government declared that District 6 was now a whites-only area. The residents of District 6 received removal letters like this one that said living there was illegal because they were not white. Bulldozers drove into District 6 and razed it to the ground.
We lived here. We had a life here.
It was very traumatic for a lot of people.
It's like ripping out someone's heart.
More than 60,000 people were forcibly removed from their homes. This kind of violence against non-white people was commonplace around the country. But after decades of pressure, both from within South Africa and abroad, apartheid rule finally came to an end. The new government lifted restrictions on where people could live. Millions of people who had been excluded from economic development for centuries migrated to major cities looking for basic services and economic opportunity.
For any family with no prospect of employment, the most rational, logical choice to make is to migrate to an urban center.
They settled where there was empty land, creating townships on the peripheries of major cities, like Cape Town. The government built millions of homes and expanded clean water and electricity.
But it had a number of unforeseen consequences, the most important of which is that the only land that could be used for the public housing program was on the periphery of the city. And for that reason, a brilliant intention to overcome the apartheid legacy unintentionally reproduced the very same legacy it was trying to undo.
Today, 60% of the mostly black population of Cape Town lives in these townships at the edge of the city. The thing is, Cape Town city center has land to develop. But because of its location, it's valuable. So it usually gets sold to private developers who build luxury apartments. Nearly $1 billion worth of them are going up by the coast. But right in the heart of Cape Town, by all the expensive developments, District 6 remains largely untouched. The former residents have fought against private development, and they've actually succeeded. Some have even managed to return to houses built by the city.
I wanted to come back year where I was born, which was part of our family's heritage.
I couldn't believe that I was back. It was a sense of relief.
But there are still hundreds of claimants waiting to get back to District 6.
We haven't done the difficult and the painful work to confront what the intergenerational consequences are of colonialism, of apartheid.
The story of Cape Town and South Africa's racial segregation starts far in the past, but it's very much entangled with the present. Apartheid and colonialism here are over, but many of the barriers they built have yet to be dismantled.
The kind of psychic scars that's left on individuals and on communities, we haven't begun the work of saying, how do we live together, right, in the face of that history?
This is my New York. These buildings, these hallways, these conversations, they raised me. So much wisdom, so much pain.
Me? I've always had a roof over my head, but as my grandma likes to tell me...
Nene, things weren't always as good as it is today. You're so lucky to have a roof over your head.
And while I had always brushed her off to the side, today was different. Today was the day I learned about the 2008 housing crisis and its disproportionate impact on Black people, an impact that was felt in my community. I call this one the darker side of the housing crisis. Redlining began in the 1930s following the Federal Housing Administration's creation to insure mortgages. If a neighborhood was identified by the FHA as too risky, banks refused to lend there. The FHA based its mortgage work on maps of metropolitan areas drawn by the Homeowners Loan Corporation. This is a HOLC color-coded map of the Los Angeles area. The green areas were equivalent to an A, or in other words, lacked a single Negro. Therefore, these green color neighborhoods were considered the perfect investment for insurance companies. Neighborhoods that consisted of a high number of Black people were colored red and rated T. The residents in these minority-dominant neighborhoods were ineligible for FHA backing. Blue areas had almost no minorities, and so they weren't perfect, but they were okay. And yellow areas were almost as bad as the red areas because they were deteriorating. The term redlining got its name from the plethora of red areas created in the metropolitan areas. It's clear from the mapping of neighborhoods around the country that redlining was a racist process. But there's more. Professors were able to uncover notes that accompanied this map of Wichita, Kansas. The notes stated that the neighborhood contained, and I quote, the heavy Negro population of Wichita. The assessors then continue on to describe the area's desirability to be as low as it could be, and that the only way the population there could increase would be through the lack of birth control among Negroes. After learning about the effect redlining had on different neighborhoods, I decided to check out my own, and what I came across was eye-opening. Here is a map of my area in Canarsie. I live here. As you can see, my area was redlined. Following my new discovery, I decided to travel around comparing the houses in my redline area to the houses a few blocks outside of it, and what I found was eye-opening. These are the houses located in my redline area. Notice how all of these houses are joined and multi-family. But then, I hit this block located outside of the redline area. Notice how these houses are single-family with front yard driveways mirroring Long Island-style housing, or in other words, a more suburban style. Because areas like my own contain Negroes, they did not receive FHA backing. This prompted the migration of whites from areas containing a few Blacks to the suburbs, which were deemed as safer investment places for insurance companies. This process is known as white flight. Despite the passage of the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which ended redlining, the high levels of segregation would naturally go unchanged. Segregated communities created a sustainable market for predatory lending. Predatory lending is when a bank or other financial institution takes unfair advantage of its customer by providing them with a loan that is highly likely to result in harm to the borrower. These loans are referred to as predatory because their high interest rates, high fees, onerous non-payment penalties, and short maturities made them considerably more expensive than typical primary market loans. Minority-dominant neighborhoods contain dense concentrations of potentially exploitable bank clients who all needed loans. On top of that, the financial institutions that existed in these minority areas were increasingly likely to be predatory. In these areas, more pawn shops, payday lenders, and check cashing services that charge high fees and usurious rates of interest were prevalent. Minorities were therefore more accustomed to exploitation and were often unaware of the better services that existed in other neighborhoods. It was easier for brokers to market subprime loans to minorities in these areas. As a matter of fact, according to the Housing and Urban Development, by the 1990s, subprime loans emerged as the most common form of predatory lending, growing by 900% between 1993 and 1999. Subprime loans were loans initially given to people who may have difficulty maintaining their repayment schedule. This applied to borrowers in the segregated communities because they were more likely to live in households with members who were unemployed, imprisoned, and/or did not have adequate medical insurance. By 1999, subprime loans were being given to any African American, regardless of whether or not they were eligible to receive the less expensive prime loan. A report done by the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation in 1996 found evidence suggesting that up to 35% of these borrowers had credentials that should have qualified them for prime loans. But let's take you back a little bit. Why did lenders suddenly begin giving subprime loans to minority-dominant areas after years of ignoring them? The CRA was a United States federal law designed to encourage banks to help meet the needs of borrowers in all communities. In order to incentivize banks to halt discriminatory credit practices, federal agencies examined banks for compliance with the CRA when approving applications for new bank branches and etc. However, encouraging banks to get involved in underprivileged communities backfired because banks have one common goal: maximizing profits. What's the fastest way to maximize profits in an underprivileged community? Exploitation. In the 1990s, the Federal National Mortgage Association began demanding proof that the banks it dealt with had discontinued discriminatory practices. This forced banks to lower their standards for borrowers, including but not limited to down payments. Banks decided to charge subprime borrowers higher interest rates to make up for their drop in standards. The floodgates to banks taking advantage of African Americans was now open. But we can't forget that banks still made profit off of African Americans who couldn't pay off their mortgage. They did this two ways. The high-income black households could afford the higher fees and interest rates that came along with subprime loans, which meant a bigger paycheck for the banks. Because African Americans were primary receivers of subprime mortgages, they were more likely to go into foreclosure as a result of the bank's recklessness. Unfortunately, in 2008, bank prices stopped increasing at high speeds. Borrowers who bought homes and went into debt had a few options. I will make you hurt. In the past, banks could recover lost money, but now home values had fallen so drastically that banks began taking increasingly large losses on defaulted loans. As a result, banks and investors began losing money. The housing market collapse had a huge impact on African Americans because it destroyed a full generation of black wealth. As a matter of fact, according to a report done by the American Civil Liberties Union, the housing crisis widened the racial gap, effectively undoing a few decades of racial progress. Beneath the stains of time. The study also concludes that while the ratio of median white wealth to black wealth was 4.4 in 1999 and decreasing until 2008, it is now projected to be 4.5 by 2034. I am still right
here. From 1502 to 1860, 9.9 million Africans were shipped around the world as slaves. Can economics explain this terrible trade? Yes, but only if we look at the whole picture. I went to school in the United States and I learned the US perspective, but the United States only received 7% of these slaves. If we want to understand the economics of slavery, we need to look at the whole picture. There were two primary drivers of the economics of slavery, and you can summarize those in just one word. I'm going to cover all that, and I'm going to tell you how studying slavery has changed my perception of economics. There were two principal drivers of where slaves ended up going in the Americas. The first was the marginal value product of labor. Think of this marble as if it was an African leaving for the Americas. It does not roll around randomly. It has some sort of direction. Slaves were bought and sold on an open market. And in markets, money is going to direct where resources are allocated. In the Americas, slaves ended up going to the places where their labor had the highest value. I mentioned this in another video about how the modern US political map mirrors an prehistoric map. I'll put a link to that at the end of this video. A lot of people like to think that ideology drove where slaves went, and that is wrong. A great history, if you're interested in the economic history of slavery in America, is to look at Gavin Wright's book, Slavery and American Economic Development. It's a great book, it's a short read, and he goes through and explains these hypotheses of ideology and how they just don't match what was happening at the time. Many of the colonies in the northern part of what would become the United States were upset that they could not get slaves at prices they wanted. They were being outbid in a competitive market for slaves. Prices drove where slaves went, and slaves were incredibly expensive. So who could afford slaves? Pretty much the only people who could buy slaves were the ones farming crops that were valuable enough to justify the price. This brings us to the one word that describes the two driving factors of slavery in America. Sugar. Today, sugar is incredibly prevalent in diets. We have it in our food, we have it in our drink, we even have it in our music. Sugar. But as late as 1650, sugar almost did not exist in European diets. Sure, there was some sugar being cultivated around the world, but nothing like what we would see in the 1700s and 1800s. We can see the increase in demand by just looking at English diets over this time. In 1650, the average English diet had close to no sugar in it in a year. By 1800s, the average English person was consuming about 30 pounds of sugar a year. And this isn't just sweetening their food, making it taste better, though that's what we usually think of today. This is a way for them to get calories in a world where calories were really hard to come by. It also increases the variety of your foods. You could add sugar to fruit in a jar, and you could actually have that fruit out of season, which is funny to me because today, if you go to the supermarket and you look up fruit cups, one of the selling points they'll try to give you is that there are no added sugars. Well, as English diets were consuming more and more sugar, obviously this demand was looking for some way to satisfy it. And that's when sugar production started expanding in the Western Hemisphere. Sugar production starts in Brazil in the late 1500s. As they improve those processes, colonization starts spreading to these other territories, and sugar cultivation is quick to follow. Sugar production becomes so profitable that sugar plantations can afford slaves. Which brings up the question, why did sugar plantations need slaves? A big hypothesis is productivity. Some people think that slaves were just more productive workers than free labor, but that is not the case. Even though it's wrong, you can see why it might make sense. Slave owners could punish slaves who had low productivity, and we know that monitoring can be an important aspect of productivity. A manager present can make it so people don't slack off as much. That's why now that I'm working a lot from home, I make sure I have manager Pikachu watching over my work so I stay on task. Since I work more when I have a monitor over me, it's easy for me to imagine that I would want to work harder if I knew that I would be whipped for low productivity. The problem with this hypothesis is that we have no evidence that slave labor was more efficient than free labor. One of the problems here is that we rarely see free labor and slave labor working in the same places. Sometimes we see on cotton farms, slave labor and free labor, we can compare their productivity there, and there's really not much of a difference. But of course, sugar is the main thing, and we don't have evidence that slave labor was more productive than free labor on sugar plantations. So what was the second driver of the slave trade? I got this machete in Haiti, and Haiti used to be the largest sugar producer in the world. Now, one of the reasons I like having this machete is because it reminds me of the second reason for where slaves ended up. They did work nobody else wanted to do. Now, there's a really gruesome way that this machete reminds me of sugar plantations, but let's start with the less horrifying reason first. This machete is like what you would have been using for harvesting sugarcane. You would cut it down, and it just turned out it was really rough work. Now, I imagine taking this out and swinging it around is a little dangerous. You might be worried about cutting your leg, you might be worried about hitting somebody else, and that indeed was the worries that they had. It was not fun work. It's also in areas with really high disease loads where you were more likely to get malaria, or you were more likely to just come down with any sort of sickness. In fact, death rates on sugar plantations were substantially higher than they were for any other crop. So yes, working on a sugar plantation was brutal, but that is not the most horrifying connection between the machete and the dangerous working conditions. This is a picture of a sugar mill. Obviously, this is not a machete, but after you had used the machete to cut down the sugar cane, you would have brought it to this mill to be processed. Here's a more modern sugar mill to give you an idea of how people process cane. You feed in the cane where the rollers crush it and the cane juice comes out the bottom. Now, I want you to notice something. Look at how carefully these men are feeding the cane into the rollers. The guy who posted this video has another video where he talks about how he got caught in this machine and he has the jacket stuck in the gears to prove it.
My coat got hung in the gears. It snatched me right on in. Started screaming for my wife.
Surely this is only a problem because this is a gas-powered machine, right? There's no way these old mills were able to catch people in them. Here's an account from somebody who lived during those times. If a mill feeder be catched by the finger, his whole body is drawn in and is squeezed to pieces. The problem of getting sucked into the machine brings me to the second reason for the machete. This was such a common problem that sometimes there was an extra slave stationed by them holding a machete ready to cut off the arm of somebody who got stuck in the machine. So not only is working on the plantation incredibly dangerous, working in the mill is dangerous. When you refine the sugar, you boil it, and that was dangerous. Every aspect of this work was incredibly dangerous. That's why initially white indentured labor was working on these sugar plantations. But when they learned that it was incredibly dangerous, they avoided it at all costs. They were able to freely enter into these contracts, and they said if that was the kind of work that they were going to do, there was no way they were going to go to those sugar plantations. Because sugar plantations could not get free labor to come work with them, they resorted to slave labor because it was still a valuable crop and nobody else wanted to farm it. So what does this teach us about economics generally? When I think about what I've learned about economics as I've studied slavery, I think about the limits of markets. Now, obviously, I'm a big fan of markets. This is called market power because we believe in the power of markets and economics to shape our world. Yet markets only work in a positive way if people are able to participate of their own free will. Look at what happened with the free labor going to sugar plantations. They could choose whether they went there or not, and they knew that it was not worth the compensation they were receiving. So they didn't go down there. Slaves did not have that choice. These were market participants who weren't freely participating. Coercing people into the market is not a morally good thing. And I think about how economics and markets require more than just prices, supply, demand, the typical economics jargon that we toss around. We also need a moral foundation. And if we don't have a moral foundation behind our economics, we're going to create a world that we do not want.
Hi, I'm John Green, and this is Crash Course European History. So today we're talking about the rejection of European rule in colonies, which resulted in a process called decolonization. By the 1970s, the majority of Europe's colonies had gained independence and formed new nations. And areas like China that were less formally controlled but did feel the heavy hand of European domination similarly had loosened ties to Europe and the United States. During the Second World War, Europeans continued to confiscate goods, seized colonized people, for forced labor, and in many cases decimate their homes and farmland. The Lord is my shepherd, and I am in want, one African wrote about post-war life. And then after World War II, literally millions of colonized subjects rose up in differing ways to achieve independence. And in doing so, they brought the colonization of the world's peoples, which had filled Europeans with pride and profits, to an end. sort of. So there was no one decolonization process. It was sometimes prolonged and often extremely violent. At other times, it was accomplished quite quickly. The first big pieces of the post-war empire to achieve independence were India and Pakistan, which became independent nations in August 1947 after decades of civil disobedience and independence activism. So although the British had claimed South Asia as a single colony, they had also stirred up Muslim-Hindu rivalries on the subcontinent with the aim of preventing people from having a unified movement for independence. That divide to continue conquering strategy persisted even as many in South Asia raged at being dragged into World War II, a war fought on behalf of their colonizers, and also at the imposition of high wartime taxes and at the constant British excuses for not granting home rule, and most horrifyingly, at the British-created Bengal famine of 1943. The Partition, the name of the South Asian settlement of 1947, arranged for the creation of two new nations, India, a majority Hindu state, and Pakistan, a majority Muslim one, but it led to a violent nightmare. Religious and other South Asian interest groups organized their own ad hoc armies to lay claims to land and resources. Sexual violence and murder were so common during the contested partition that, as one woman explained, "My three sisters swallowed poison. Our hospital compounder distributed poison to anyone who wanted it." Other women escaped rape and torture through other methods of suicide. That same person also recalled, "My bua," that is aunt, "gave the signal to the other women to jump by jumping off the bridge first. Then other aunts, my bobbies," that is aunts and cousins, "six in all, killed themselves. No one tried to stop them, not even my father." More than a million people would die in the wars that followed partition, and eventually the two countries became three, with Bangladesh becoming independent in 1971. India would become, and remains, the largest democracy in the world. China threw off the informal grip of the European and US powers when Mao Zedong and his communist forces first helped in the World War II defeat of Japan, and then took control from the opposing nationalists in 1949. This victory heightened Cold War tensions as the new People's Republic of China initially allied itself with the USSR. Communist forces aimed to defeat US and Western European influence in Vietnam and Korea in the post-war period. The Korean and Vietnamese wars are often seen as proxy wars between the superpowers, but if you shift perspectives, they can also be seen as wars of liberation. Less violent scenarios also materialized, with activists launching strikes and civil disobedience or negotiations to achieve independence. Ghana, Morocco, and Tunisia are examples of comparatively peaceful liberation. In contrast, where there were numerous white settlers like Algeria or Kenya, Europeans fought tenaciously to keep their colonies. They employed torture, confiscated farms and houses, and incarcerated surviving local people in concentration camps with very high mortality rates. Kenyans, for example, swore solemn oaths to fight for freedom, and in doing so became part of the Land and Freedom Army, or Mau Mau movement. The British fought back, destroying villages and massacring the population while driving others into those lethal concentration camps. One Kenyan teenager, returning home from school in another town, was walking absentmindedly along the road toward his house when, quote, "Instinct suddenly tells me that I have gotten home, or where home should be. Our homestead is a rubble of burnt dry mud, splinters of wood, and grass. I suddenly realized that the whole village of homesteads has disappeared." But despite Britain's wars to retain colonies, they eventually did have to grant Kenya independence in 1963. In the war to liberate Algeria, where some 3 million Europeans had settled on the land of local people, French military resistance to the National Liberation Front of Freedom Fighters was especially vicious. The FLN, as it was known, was weak in armed power compared to the French, so it gained its strength from simply depicting the French torture of local people in detail. It ensured, for instance, that militant Algerian nationalist Jamila Boupacha's account of her torture reached a worldwide audience in February 1960. Now, some of this account is too barbaric to repeat here, but I will share an abridged version with the caveat that some listeners may just want to skip ahead 30 seconds. She wrote, I received terrible blows that made me fall to the ground. That was when the soldiers, led by a parachutist captain, crushed my ribs with their boots. Bupacha was then transferred to, quote, receive the second decree. I soon found out what that meant, electric torture to begin with. Then they burned me in the same way on my legs, groin, genitals, and face. Electric torture alternated with cigarette burns, punches with fists, and water torture. Suspended over a full bathtub, I was made to drink until suffocating. And those reports did shape French public opinion, especially after being amplified by French intellectuals like Simone de Beauvoir. The president of France, Charles de Gaulle, ended the war in 1962, and Algeria gained its independence. By 1980, most areas around the world had gained their freedom from European rule, but often at great cost. Already weak infrastructure was at times further damaged by struggles for independence, and many of these new nations were left with systems designed only to facilitate the extraction of resources rather than the improvement of communities. Building infrastructure that didn't focus on resource extraction would prove an exceptionally difficult and costly facet of decolonization, one that continues to be a problem for many impoverished post-colonial states today. But that's only one facet of decolonization. The end of empire affected Europe and the world enormously in many different ways. The Caribbean-born physician Frantz Fanon wrote globally influential books on race and the need for those ruled by Europeans to decolonize not just their countries, but also their minds of the many European influences that had been forced upon them. Let's go to the thought bubble. Along these lines, liberation leader Funmilayo Ransom Kuti and other African women returned to traditional clothing, rejecting British dress codes and claims to cultural superiority. For Ransom Kuti, this meant wearing Yoruba garments. Others chose various local forms of cotton garb and headpieces. Frantz Fanon also argued that freedom fighters used violence because that was all they knew about conducting their lives. Europeans had ruled with violence, so violence endured in many newly independent nations as they struggled to create governments and societies out of the economic and psychological wreckage of colonial rule. Some decolonizing people migrated to Europe to escape this turmoil and the impoverishment of their regions. Britain legislated that they could do so, and economically, this migration was a big blessing for the receiving countries because in most places, including the United States, immigrants could be taken advantage of, which meant governments and businesses could cut costs. In Europe, immigrants staffed the lowest levels of the welfare state, becoming janitors and sanitation workers, even when they were trained and certified doctors and nurses. They also helped Europe rebuild its war-torn buildings and roads and railroads and other infrastructure. For decolonizing countries, the loss of these workers was more complex because, in many cases, new nations lost their best educated and most highly skilled workers. Thanks, Thought Bubble. The exploitation of these immigrants continued that of empire itself. As immigrants from the colonies arrived in Europe, European racism swelled and became an integral part of decolonization and its politics. In 1958, whites rioted when a black man struck up a conversation with a white woman. In 1968, British politician Enoch Powell gave his Rivers of Blood speech, announcing that because of immigrants' presence in Britain, specifically people of color, whites saw their property values decline and their access to health care given to immigrants. So anti-immigration came to stand for curtailing the arrival of people of color. But to be clear, again, receiving nations benefited from this immigration. Meanwhile, new forms of imperialism called neo-imperialism developed as newly independent governments needed to borrow money and sought experienced advisors to build the elements of statehood, such as schools and hospitals and harbors, roads and railroads. European and U.S. financiers and technicians exercised enormous control over these efforts and often manipulated development to support ongoing dependence that, if not exactly colonial, was at least neo-colonial. Hence the term. Now, I know there remains a widespread belief that communities were somehow better off as colonies than as newly independent nations, but the data just does not back that up. Average life expectancy in sub-Saharan Africa in 1953 was under 40. By 1980, it was over 50. Rates of malnutrition declined, while far more children learned to read and attended school for longer. The same was true in South Asia and East Asia. Some Europeans did stay in their former colonies to continue their businesses, and some administrators stayed to serve as advisors. But many also used the uncertain times to retrieve funds from colonies and begin the system of offshore banking. In the meantime, the superpowers targeted these new nations to gain their allegiance in the Cold War. Egypt was an early pawn when it sought funds for the Aswan Dam, first obtaining them from the USSR, and then the British, French, and Israelis invaded Egypt in 1956 in a failed attempt to prevent the leader Gamal Abdel Nasser from nationalizing the Suez Canal. The United States actually stopped that invasion by cutting off funds to the British. They did this out of a fear of strengthening the Soviet hand. Emerging nations might worry about similar attacks by US allies and seek out the Soviets for protection. And the superpowers continued taking sides by providing competing groups in Africa and Asia and in the Americas with funds, perpetuating turmoil and ensuring that the newly independent countries would remain weak and at the mercy of superpower aid. And this gets at something really important, which is that during the Cold War, aid wasn't really designed to like minimize human suffering or to build infrastructure. Really, it was designed to increase dependence on either one way of thinking, the communist way, or another way, the capitalist way. And in that process, the superpowers encouraged not just big proxy wars like those in Korea and Vietnam, but also smaller local conflicts. But despite all this turmoil, as diversity and multiculturalism accelerated, so did the exchange of ideas. To cite just one famous example, late in the 1950s, Trinidadian immigrant Lord Woodbine, Harold Phillips, took in aspiring musicians to learn steel band instruments, calypso and the blues. Two white boys he trained used the imported musical style to break off and become the Beatles. Immigrant writers from around the world shared stories of colonial and post-colonial life, and in doing so began to give voice to those who'd been structurally silenced. And so the Columbian Exchange continued, despite the ongoing racism and discrimination. Much more exchange, this time in realms of science and technology, was also taking place, and we'll be talking about that next time. I'll see you then.
Hey everyone, Noah Zerbe here. This is one of a series of videos looking at concepts in development. In this video, we're going to look at the Washington Consensus, the ideological framework that underscored mainstream development programs from the 1980s at least through the early 2000s, and arguably even into today. It was the philosophy that underscored structural adjustment programming and was the key foundation to development thinking for decades. So let's get to it. The term Washington Consensus was first articulated in a 1989 article by John Williamson, a British economist at the World Bank. In it, Williamson outlined what he observed to be the 10 common features or principles of development thinking in Latin America in the 1980s. Broadly speaking, the Washington Consensus encompassed a series of policy reforms envisioned by the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the U.S. Treasury Department. Collectively, these reforms centered on a rejection of state-led or interventionist approaches to development and instead focused on free market-based policies. Initially derived from policy reforms in Latin America, the Washington Consensus quickly became the primary prescription for economic development around the world. At its most basic level, the consensus emphasized macroeconomic discipline, a market economy, and openness to the world economy. At its heart, the Washington Consensus built on the belief that if state enterprises are privatized, government regulation is reduced, inflation is kept in check, the money supply is kept tight as part of controlling inflation, and market prices are set free, then foreign investment will flow in, producing prosperity and economic development. More specifically, the Washington Consensus outlined 10 specific principles which it contended were necessary to secure the conditions under which development could be achieved. The first element of the consensus was the need to establish fiscal discipline. This need was rooted in three central beliefs. First, that economic stability, that is, low rates of inflation, were a prerequisite for securing economic growth, and that economic stability and large government deficits undermined that price stability and threatened to increase inflation in the economy. Remember that inflation is a general decline in the purchasing power of money, or conversely, a general increase in the price of goods in an economy. While a little inflation is fine, high rates of inflation tend to undermine confidence in the economy and thus decrease economic growth rates. price stability, the Washington Consensus argued, was undermined by large government deficits. Therefore, maintaining fiscal discipline and reducing government expenditures was the first step in achieving the conditions for economic growth. Early on, the Washington Consensus also held that government expenditures should be sharply curtailed. Initially, reductions in government spending tended to be broad-based and often meant sharp cuts in social spending on education, healthcare, and other needs. Popular protest led to a reformulation of the consensus and an assertion that efforts to reduce government spending should focus on the question of merit. Government spending should be rationalized either in terms of offsetting externalities or improving income distribution. Other spending, often dubbed non-merit subsidies, should be avoided. Put simply, non-merit subsidies essentially refer to government spending that cannot be rationalized either as offsetting externalities or by improving income distribution. Such spending, according to the Washington Consensus, should generally be avoided. And instead, public expenditures should prioritize areas which offered both high economic returns and the potential to improve income distribution. These would include policies like primary health care, primary education, and infrastructure. Third, the consensus promoted the need to reform the tax system in two key ways. First, it proposed that the tax base should be broadened by bringing more economic activity into the formal sector and by creating a more uniform tax code. This would help generate more tax revenue to pay off the debt that was driving the need for structural reform in the first place. Secondly, and more controversially, the Washington Consensus asserted the need to cut the marginal tax rate. Cutting taxes, it was argued, would have two important effects. It would promote foreign direct investment as a result of lower tax rates, making the economy more competitive globally. But counterintuitively, it was argued that cutting the marginal tax rate would actually increase the amount of tax revenue collected. The idea was suggested by the Laffer curve, named for the economist Arthur Laffer. The Laffer curve, which we examined in another video, suggests that tax revenues will increase as the tax rate up to a certain point increases. But after that, tax rates would actually decline as people either moved their money abroad to avoid paying taxes or chose not to work since the government would claim a larger and larger portion of income. As a result, the Laffer curve contends that lowering the marginal tax rate counterintuitively may actually increase government revenue by stimulating more economic activity. I should also note that this argument has been made in favor of many tax cuts in the United States, and it's hotly debated as to whether or not such tax cuts actually increase government revenue. Nevertheless, such arguments are included as a central part of the Washington Consensus. The Washington Consensus also encompassed broad liberalization of the economy. Generally speaking, liberalization refers to efforts to reduce the role of the government in the economy and opening the economy to global market forces. More specifically, liberalization usually involves reducing controls over interest rates, trade rules, foreign direct investment, and other regulations. Point 4 of the consensus argued in favor of liberalizing interest rates. Point 6 promoted the liberalization of international trade by cutting tariffs and limiting quotas and other non-tariff barriers to trade. Point 7 called for the liberalization of rules governing foreign direct investment, essentially making it easier for capital to flow in and out of the country. And point 9 called for the deregulation of the economy or the eradication of regulations and politics restructuring competition or creating trade barriers to entry into the market. Broadly speaking, it called for a deregulation of the economy. Point 5 of the consensus called for the use of floating rather than fixed or pegged exchange rate systems. We discussed exchange rate systems in another video, but the point of this in the context of the Washington consensus was that floating exchange rates permitted currency devaluation. Historically, many developing countries had overvalued their currencies in an effort to make imports more expensive and thus foster domestic economic activity and production. But the Washington Consensus argued in favor of the opposite approach. Countries should devalue their currencies in an effort to be more competitive globally while reducing imports. If the costs of production are priced primarily in local currency terms, this makes sense. Devaluing your currency will make your exports cheaper in the context of global economics, fueling economic development. The challenge, though, is that demand for primary commodities was relatively inelastic. Price decreases did not always generate increased demand in global markets. Further, as many developing countries were devaluing their currencies simultaneously, a general downward trend in prices for many of their primary commodities occurred, eliminating many of the supposed benefits of devaluation in the first place. Nevertheless, currency devaluation became a common focal point for Washington Consensus policies. The final two elements of the Washington Consensus centered on the expansion and protection of private property rights. Point 8 called for a privatization of state-owned enterprises. This argument, embodied in the consensus, was that states had expanded too broadly and that selling off or privatizing state enterprises would increase efficiency, reduce prices, and expand the availability of services. In practice, however, the private sector did not necessarily replicate the coverage provided by the state. Introduction of school fees also led to a reduction in school enrollments. Privatization of electricity and water service delivery led to massive disconnections in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. It also sparked popular protest, and privatization of state services became a lightning rod for opposition to the consensus in countries around the world. And finally, point 10 called for the establishment of private property rights. While the Washington Consensus emerged out of the experiences of Latin America, it quickly became the default model for development, most notably operationalized through the International Monetary Fund in structural adjustment programming, the mandatory conditions countries had to meet to be eligible for emergency assistance from IMF, and particularly after the 1980s, to secure the seal of approval necessary to borrow from private creditors as well. Not surprisingly, the consensus also generated considerable controversy and criticism. Some of the most poignant criticism came from inside the international financial institutions themselves. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, who served as chief economist of the World Bank from 1997 to 2000, was particularly critical. Stiglitz argued that the Washington Consensus was presented as a one-size-fits-all solution that ignored local expertise and experience on the ground and assumed that all countries faced the same problems. According to Stiglitz, when the IMF decides to assist a country, it dispatches a mission of economists. These economists frequently lack extensive experience in the country. They are more likely to have first-hand knowledge of its five-star hotels than of the villages that dot its countryside. Needless to say, a little number crunching rarely provides adequate insights into the development strategy for an entire nation. Stiglitz continues, "Even worse, the number crunching isn't always that good. The mathematical models the IMF uses are frequently flawed or out of date. Critics accuse the institution of taking a cookie-cutter approach to economics, and they're right. Country teams have been known to comprise draft reports even before visiting. I heard stories of one unfortunate incident where team members copied large parts of the text for one country's report and transferred them wholesale into another. They might have gotten away with it, except the search and replace function on the word processor didn't work properly, leaving the original country's name in a few places. Oops." And in his most pointed critique, Stiglitz asserted that it's not fair to say that IMF economists don't care about the citizens of developing nations, but the older men who staff the fund, and they're overwhelmingly older men, act as if they're shouldering Rudyard Kipling's White Man's Burden. IMF experts believe they are brighter, more educated, and less politically motivated than the economists in the countries they visit. In fact, the economic leaders from those countries are pretty good, in many cases brighter or better educated than the IMF staff, which frequently consists of third-rate students from first-rate universities. It's hardly a ringing endorsement. But probably the most damning critique of the consensus comes from an effort to answer the question of whether or not it worked. While the broad principles of the consensus made sense in theory, in practice they often failed to deliver on economic growth. As this graph suggests, across a wide range of Latin American countries that undertook consensus-style reforms, economic growth actually slowed after the model was adopted. The one exception was Chile, where growth rates picked up, but in every other country in the region that followed the policies, growth actually slowed, and indeed, in many, the 1980s became known as the lost decade for development. So that concludes our very brief introduction to the Washington Consensus. Be sure to check out the other videos in the series, and thanks for watching, everyone. Have a good day. Bye.
The U.S. military is one of the most powerful militaries in the world, and its presence is felt on a global level, literally. It has bases set up all over the world, and they are unbelievable, and also a tad controversial. As of the summer of 2021, the United States operated about 750 military bases in foreign countries. American Army, Navy, and air bases can be found on every continent except Antarctica. Other bases exist on the high oceans. Although there are not as many overseas American military bases now as there were during the Cold War, more countries have since signed up to host them on their home soil. The presence of these bases in strategic areas is critical to American foreign policy, although they have been a source of controversy both in the United States and abroad. In this episode, we'll take a look at some of the more notable bases, their origins and importance, and the controversy that surrounds them. For the first century of its existence, the United States was reluctant to entangle itself in the affairs of other countries outside of the Western Hemisphere. It maintained a policy of neutrality and did not have large permanent military missions overseas. That slowly began to change with the Spanish-American War. America's victory in that conflict saw its emergence as a bona fide world power, with a military presence in Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Cuba. America's victory over Spain was the origin of the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, which opened in 1903, based on a permanent basis with the newly independent government of Cuba, which was then friendly to the United States. This makes Guantanamo the oldest American overseas naval base in the world. Since 9/11, it has become notorious for its detention center, where unsavory methods have been used on what the United States calls detained foreign enemy combatants in the War on Terror. This designation is the justification for skirting the Geneva Convention and other treaties on the treatment of prisoners of war. The treatment of these prisoners was a source of partisan dispute in the 2000s and led to calls among some Americans to close the base. However, Guantanamo's controversy extends much further back than the War on Terror. Since taking power in 1959, the communist government of Cuba has repeatedly protested the base's presence on its soil. There is little that it can do about the base, however, as the lease will only end through mutual agreement or American abandonment. This is unlikely because, in addition to its use in the War on Terror, Guantanamo gives the US Navy a forward presence in the Western Hemisphere. With China increasingly interested in striking up partnerships with countries in the Americas, the United States will want to keep the base as part of a 21st century Monroe Doctrine, even if direct reference to that long tradition is no longer fashionable in Washington. The United States also maintains a presence in the Philippines, another tradition that began in the Spanish-American War. Spain's defeat led the Philippines to become an American colony, with many military personnel stationed there. The Philippines achieved its full independence after the end of World War II, but there are still two small American bases there on both sides of Manila Bay. These outposts augment American power projection into the disputed waters of the South China Sea, where the Philippines is embroiled in a bitter international controversy with China over the latter's expansion into its exclusive economic zone and island-building campaign. This leftover legacy from the Spanish-American War is therefore more relevant now than it was during the Cold War, as the South China Sea becomes one of the biggest points of contention between the great powers of the 21st century. Although the United States began to assert a more formidable presence on the world stage after the Spanish-American War, it was not until World War II that it built large numbers of overseas bases. That was only supposed to be temporary too, just as it was in the First World War. Even after its victory over Germany and Japan, America was slowly but surely beginning to retreat behind its traditional frontiers, until the Soviet Union and its allies tried to exploit post-war vulnerabilities. Containing the threat of communism became the highest foreign policy priority for Washington between the late 1940s and 1991. This priority was punctuated by the founding of NATO in 1949 and intervention in the Korean War in 1950. These policy shifts put the United States in the mode of permanent forward presence. The Korean War led to the establishment of a string of permanent bases in South Korea, ranging all over the country. These include the Chinhae Naval Base, two air bases, and a string of army bases, most of them near the DMZ. Although the relevancy of these bases has been called into question in both the United States and South Korea after the end of the Cold War, the United States' presence in that country is now more important than it has been since the fall of the Soviet Union, as China and North Korea make aggressive moves to undermine the post-Cold War international order. The bases in South Korea give the United States a presence on the East Asian mainland, which is critical for America's ability to counter China's military expansionism and North Korea's nuclear saber-rattling. Similarly, Japan hosts many American bases, There are over 50,000 American soldiers, sailors, and airmen stationed in Japan, more than any other foreign country. The United States bases in Japan are concentrated on the southern island of Okinawa, but a few may also be found on the Japanese main island of Honshu. The bases originate from the United States' victory over Japan in World War II, its occupation of that country in the aftermath, and the subsequent Treaty of Alliance between them. This security treaty committed the United States to Japan's defense and allowed American bases on the latter's soil. In keeping with its pacifist post-World War II constitution, the arrangement was essentially for Japan to outsource many of its military functions to the United States. Japan could have a self-defense force, but not a military capable of offensive power projection. These functions would be taken care of by the United States. The American bases, especially the ones on Okinawa, have been the subject of controversy in Japan. Local Okinawan residents have long resented the base's environmental impact, noise pollution, and incidents involving drugs and criminality that have escaped the jurisdiction of local courts. However, the bases in Japan, especially in Okinawa, are now more important than they were even in the Cold War, and not just for the United States, as the Indo-Pacific region becomes the center of great power competition in the 21st century. As an example, China has recently claimed it is the legitimate ruling authority for the Senkaku Islands in Japan's southern reaches. Even Okinawa itself has at times come under territorial dispute, with some Chinese authorities claiming that Japan has no legitimate historical claim to the island. Further afield, China's naval buildup that threatens Taiwan and the South China Sea trade routes also threatens to cut Japan, a relatively resource-poor country, off from the critical material it needs to import. America's bases in Japan are vital for both countries' ability to project enough power to deter and thwart China's aims in the region. America's bases in Japan once carried nuclear weapons, but these were removed in the 1970s after controversy. Growing competition with China has prompted some Japanese leaders, including the late former PM Shinzo Abe, to suggest that the nukes may need to return there. As Japan pursues rearmament with a 2% of GDP target for its defense spending by 2027, it seems likely that the controversy of America's presence there will continue for the foreseeable future, as the Japanese people may see less of a need for the bases if they can take better care of their own security. Slowly but surely, Japan is reinterpreting the pacifist Article 9 in its constitution and becoming more militarily capable. The bases in Japan and South Korea have recently stirred controversy on the other side of the Pacific too. They came under increased scrutiny in the United States during the American presidential election of 2016. There, then-candidate Donald Trump suggested that the United States was not getting a good deal on the bases, and that if South Korea and Japan did not pay more, it might be better for them to build nuclear weapons to defend themselves from North Korea and China. The statements rattled leaders in Japan and South Korea, but as the Trump presidency was characterized by increased competition with China, the bases became more important, and he did not make any moves to change the status quo during his time in the White House. The United States also maintains an extensive military presence in Europe, with bases in Portugal, Spain, the United Kingdom, Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, Greece, Poland, Lithuania, Romania, and above all in Germany, where around 35,000 American military personnel are stationed. Most of the German-based troops are hosted at Ramstein Air Base in southern Germany. It is the largest American military installation outside of the United States. This base had its beginnings in 1951 and was actually designed by French and German engineers and an international work crew. The 3,000-acre base was originally a swamp, and the infrastructure needed to be built up by a height of 2 meters for it to be stable. Today, the base not only hosts American troops, but is an important site for many other NATO functions. Ramstein and other bases in Germany began as part of America's occupation of the country after the end of World War II, which is partly why most of them are still in the south of the country, which was the zone the United States was given responsibility for. Germany was at the center of Cold War tensions, making the American bases there more important and permanent. The bases gave the United States and its NATO allies the ability to rapidly deploy and supply the troops that would be needed on the front lines of a confrontation with the Soviet Union, which controlled all of Eastern Europe and much of Germany. But things have changed dramatically since then. The relevancy of Ramstein and other bases in Germany has been called into question in recent years with NATO's eastward expansion after the end of the Cold War. Many American policymakers on both sides of the political aisle, Donald Trump being the most well-known, have questioned the continued need for these bases, as Germany has persistently and stubbornly fallen short of the NATO mark of spending 2% of its GDP on defense. Meanwhile, the geopolitical fault line with Russia has shifted far to the east, as the war in Ukraine and tension along the Baltic Sea shows. Even President Obama, who was very popular in Germany, derisively referred to the Germans and other NATO allies as free riders in a 2016 interview with The Atlantic for not owning up to their NATO defense spending pledges. In response to Germany's negligence and new strategic reality, some policymakers have called for the bulk of American troops in Europe to be shifted eastward to Poland, a country which is meeting its NATO obligations and is closer to the European geopolitical fault line of the 21st century. Initial moves of this sort were made in 2020, when some American troops were sent from Germany to Poland. The Poles agreed to fund some of the infrastructure and logistical support needed to make this happen. The move came as part of a broader redistribution of American troops around Europe. In June of 2020, then-President Trump announced his intention to cut American troops stationed in Germany to 25,000, with a redistribution of about 10,000 of them to bases in Belgium and Italy. After Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Germany announced that it would modernize its military and spend 2% of its GDP on defense. But over a year later, the math still does not add up, according to the German Economic Institute, a think tank based in Cologne. In March 2023, Germany put its pledge in writing to show more seriousness. However, there are still skeptics who say they've heard this before. As of the autumn 2020, Greece, the United Kingdom, Romania, Poland, and Lithuania were the NATO countries with American bases on their territory that met the 2% target. Perhaps this is why the bases there are less well-known or controversial in the United States. One of the more important bases in the region is Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. The base's official mission is to defend NATO's southern flank. Incirlik originated in 1943, when Allied leaders agreed that a new airbase south of the Turkish capital Ankara should be built. Construction began in 1951, and Turkey joined NATO in 1952. This base serves as a host to some of the United States' tactical nuclear weapons, like the B-61 bomb. It also allows the American and Allied air forces to project power into the Black Sea, the Caucasus, and the Middle East, making it an important piece on the geopolitical chessboard and a check on Russian and Iranian influence. Although the relative importance of the theater has decreased in the wake of the rise of China in Asia and a more aggressive Russia in Europe, the United States maintains a significant military posture in the Middle East. It has a presence in Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iraq, Israel, and Jordan. All told, there are about 7,500 American soldiers, sailors, and airmen stationed between these bases as of 2023. The naval bases in Bahrain and Dubai, in particular, allow the United States to project rapid power into the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, which sees the transit of a third of the world's liquefied natural gas and 20% of the world's crude oil. The United States' naval presence there acts as a check on Iran and, in a more extended way, China, since most of the outbound energy products in these waters are on a course for East Asia. The presence of these bases grows further in importance for the United States when it considers that China built its first overseas military base, the People's Liberation Army Support Base in Djibouti several years ago, and is continuing to expand its capacity. As of 2021, about 2,000 Chinese military personnel were stationed on this base, and it is expanding its capabilities. Although the advent of shale energy has reduced the strategic importance of this oil-producing region for the American energy supply, keeping the waters of the Red Sea and Persian Gulf from drifting too far into China's orbit means that the Middle East will remain an important region for American foreign policy. The United States also operates the Diego Garcia Naval Base jointly with the United Kingdom in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Technically, it is United Kingdom territory. Diego Garcia has its origin in 1814, when the British gained control of it and the atoll it is part of from the French. In 1965, Diego Garcia officially became the British Indian Ocean Territory, and the following year, it was agreed that the United States and Britain would create a joint naval base there. Construction began in 1971. The local inhabitants were expelled from the island as part of this process. The base's mission is to provide critical support to US and Allied forces forward deployed to the Indian Ocean, while supporting multi-theater forces operating in the CENTCOM, AFRICOM, EUCOM, and PACCOM areas of responsibilities in support of overseas contingency operations. The mission statement is a bit clunky, but otherwise apt, because Diego Garcia allows the Allies to project power on the crossroads between Africa, South Asia, and Australia. In the event of hostilities, Diego Garcia is another installation which would allow for a rapid deployment to disrupt the ocean-going trade that China depends on. Ships from Diego Garcia would be able to move rapidly to the Persian Gulf or the Strait of Malacca, for instance, and cut off vital shipping lanes. Meanwhile, since China has been making significant investments on the African continent, including with plans for more military bases, the Diego Garcia naval station acts as an important check on China's ambitions in the region, and its presence is something the Chinese leadership will need to take into consideration when it makes its plans for Africa and the Indian Ocean. The United States does not have much of a permanent presence in Africa, but it does have a few. A particularly interesting base is Camp Limonière in Djibouti on the continent's Horn. The base supports about 4,000 active personnel and allows the United States to project power directly into the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, supplementing the Middle Eastern bases. Camp Limonière began as a French military base before the armed forces of Djibouti took it over. In the early 2000s, the United States established itself there to conduct counter-terrorism operations on the Horn of Africa as part of the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, CJTF-HOA. Now, as the United States shifts its strategic posture away from the war on terror and toward great power competition, Camp Limonier takes on a new importance. As we have also seen, this base is close to China's only overseas base, allowing the United States to more easily monitor and quickly check the activities of its primary strategic competitor. It is another example of an old base being refit for a new purpose. The United States is by far the world's largest military spender, with over $750 billion allotted to its armed forces in 2020. Much of its spending is on the overseas deployments that we've discussed. Overseas military deployments have been a subject of controversy on both sides of the political aisle in the American homeland, especially after the long counterinsurgency campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan that left the American public war-weary. Many Americans wonder why the United States spends so much money on overseas military commitments instead of taking care of needs in the homeland. This is a tendency that has been strong ever since the foundation of the American body politic, and most famously expressed in George Washington's 1976 farewell address, when he told the nation he wished to steer clear of any permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world. The United States became the world's unwilling and accidental superpower in World War II, but its founding fathers' words remain a big part of America's psyche. Russia's invasion of Ukraine changed the political chessboard somewhat, as most Americans support arming the Ukrainians and checking Russia's further ambitions in Europe. Most Americans also recognize the dangers China poses, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. However, there is still an extreme reluctance for new overseas combat missions by the American military. As America's allies like Japan and Germany pledge that they will rearm and therefore bring their own checks to foreign adversaries like China and Russia, the American overseas bases may be called further into question by people on both sides of the ocean. The American people could feel less of a need for their expense, while those in other countries may feel less of a need for their security presence and the environmental and social costs that come with them. Time will tell, though it's unlikely they will be going anywhere soon. But what do you think about America's overseas military bases? Which ones have grown more or less important? And are some of them still necessary? Let us know in the comments, and don't forget to subscribe for more military analysis from military experts.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Dun 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 d
yeah. And welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. Why capitalism has to die. Because capitalism is a system created to promote and maintain the dominance, or rather, to promote and maintain minoritarian white rule over the world. I thought about placing dominant and dominance there, but I changed it at the last minute. Because dominance was what was aimed for amongst the European powers prior to World War II. Each country was trying to dominate more of the world so that they can then dominate the other European countries. That's the mystery revelation in imperialism that is often unstated. Imperialism was a game created by European powers, centered upon and focus driven towards the idea of one European power dominating all the others. Literally, that was the reason and purpose for imperialism. Each wanted to outdo the others by collecting more land, controlling more land, controlling more people, controlling more natural elements, resources, building up the wealth that they have, or had, excuse me, based on taking over more land, resources, people, natural elements, and then shoving it in the face of other European powers and saying, we now control more than you do. You may say, and I believe rightfully, that this is foolhardy. Europe, even collectively, has always been a small percentage of the global population. But you've ever heard of the Napoleon complex? Just as I believed back in 2017, that Trump was a reproduction of American psyche, that he was a creation that embodied all of the terrible and blatant aspects of collective America's psyche. I believe Napoleon was similarly built. He was a person created by the collective European mind, or in the image of the collective European mind. And his complex, which is infamous, was the complex of Europe. A small enclave that in reality is West Asian in placement. Europe has no natural boundary. India has more of a right to call itself a continent than Europe does. They saw themselves as something greater than the whole that they were a part of. So instead of them being West Asian, they became something altogether different. And they believed, through that distorted view of who they themselves were, that they had a right to not only construct all of Asia, but they had a right to construct the entire world and to rule over it. The question was how? Imperialism, colonialism, settler colonialism were the first tools. Through time, that evolved. It evolved them. It had to. You know, when you go from creating colonies on African soil, which is a hop, skip, and a jump from where you're at, to now being able to create colonies thousands of miles away in far off places, include which have on them animals and vegetative species that you've never encountered. A reality that was made possible by the invaders of West Asia, the Moors, who taught them how to structure their government in a way that would allow expansiveness to not sap control. But when you do that, you begin to stretch your culture, to change your culture. And that happened with Europe. But I'm kind of off track a little bit here. The games played when it came to controlling these colonies was surrounded completely the idea of being able to promote yourself as bigger than your other competitors. That is why they kept pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing to annex more and more and more land, even though they knew they could not do anything with it. They may have not even had full control of it. Most of the time, they didn't. Most of what Spain claimed as its own, there wasn't tons of Spaniards living on it. It was just on a map. They said, this is ours. The goal was dominance over one another while they sought to dominate places outside of their own home. From imperialism, colonialism, and settler colonialism came mercantilism. And soon, that became capitalism. Capitalism was and is the flower from the seed of Europeanness, particularly Europe's political economic legacy, which is feudalism. I've made that statement many times before, and I know some economists don't like it. They look and they go, oh, but there were so many differences. It's the basic cultural realities that have been transmitted that most economists can't see because most economists don't study culture. They're so wrapped up in the numbers that they forget, as one brilliant African scholar put it, your economics is your culture. What you do culturally will feed your economics. A great Western example of this is the Roman Republic. The Roman Republic started off as a small group of tribes that needed to expand to maintain their health. They didn't have enough land to take care of themselves. Their economics flowed from that. And even after they had technically gained enough land where they could take care of themselves, their economic system didn't alter, which made expansion a central theme for the empire that would come and the republic that would obviously blossom out of that. The economic system never adjusted to a new reality. Feudalism caused the need, the poverty that feudalism caused, and some stuff that happened with the Moors afterwards, because the Moors actually rescued them from a lot of that poverty, but feudalism caused the need, the want, the desire to go overseas. And that was the catalyst for imperialism. Colonialism, well, imperialism, colonialism, settler colonialism, and mercantilism were all a result of that desire. Capitalism was the end stage to the initial act of imperialism. What is often unsaid is without the genociding of tens of millions, well over 100 million, probably well over a couple hundred million people during this period of time from 1942 through, I'm sorry, through from 1492 to maybe 1945, and probably we could count all of the millions of deaths, tens of millions of deaths that came in the post-World War II years. But without all of that genociding, which probably puts it well over 300 million people, capitalism wouldn't have worked. Why? Because, one, most of the people killed, especially from 1492 to the early 1900s, these people were considered in the way of capitalist progress. They were either native indigenous people or people who refused to let go of old traditional ways that provided families with enough sustenance and didn't render them slaves to employers. It took the power out of the hands of the capitalists, in other words. So a lot of those people ended up being killed. The industrial wars that marked, I mean, still marks it today, we're now in a more techno-war framework presently, but the industrial wars of the first half, and maybe the first half of the 1900s, most of those people, again, in the way of capitalism taking hold in former colonies, and taken hold in colonies. Literally, tens of millions of people killed so capitalism could work its magic. That was necessary. Dispossessing people of land, necessary for capitalism to expand, for capitalism to do what it had to do. But we don't see it like that. We are told by corporate conservatives constantly, oh yeah, this is just natural. Capitalism is the best and the most brilliant and the most wonderful. It's what made America, America. No, no. What made America, America, particularly the one that everybody likes to point to as being, oh, well, look at how equal people are and look at how well they get paid. And yeah, that was done by the federal government slapping capitalists around finally in the 1940s and 50s and saying, you're not going to do what you did in the 1800s. That's actually what made America, quote-unquote, great. But I digress. Capitalism as the flower of imperialism? Undergirds white supremacy at every single turn. At a macro level, and this isn't taught to you anywhere, so far as I could tell, unless you're in a cultural class, Capitalism, even to this day, prioritizes the well-being of European states ahead of other states. Why do you think nearly 100 years after colonialism supposedly ended, most of the former colonies are in absolutely terrible shape, infrastructure-wise? Why do you think those countries haven't made too much progress in quote-unquote, developing themselves? Because even to this day, the primary focus of capitalism is the European states. And just so we don't get confused here, the United States of America is a European state. It may claim that it's not. But when all of these white nationalists talk about their heritage, you know where they trace their heritage back to? Europe. They're not even shy about it. In fact, there was a video that went viral a few years back. And the video was of some guy talking about how they needed to protect the virtue of white women and how white women were the standard of beauty for the world. And that without white women's beauty, the rest of the world would basically be lost. And the pictures, because there were tons of pictures in this video. I watched it. I listened to it. All of the pictures, and they had them marked, were from Europe. Were from Europe. The standard of beauty among these white nationalists is European women. In this country, the white nationalists know they are a European state. And they treat this country like it is a European-dominated state. Everybody else, as is said by one of my favorite YouTubers, is just a visitor. Everybody else is just a visitor. They know who this country supposedly belongs to. And I say supposedly because they ain't never been right about that. This land is borrowed, taken from the true inhabitants. And those true inhabitants are coming back. But I digress. Capitalism prioritizes the topmost importance in capitalism is to keep European states wealthy. We often downplay this reality and everything that we talk about when it comes to capitalism. But the reality is why France has a great social welfare system is because they're still pillaging African countries who used to be their former colonies. And even more egregious function of this prioritization is the valuation of materials. And this is something that I was thinking about the other day. Why is it that African countries and South African countries have significant mineral deposits, and yet they are so poor? Why? Because the way that the system, capitalism, values things is exactly that way. They value things as greater than natural elements. I want you to think about that. Capitalism devalues natural elements, which often can only be found in non-white countries. But as soon as white people take those things and manipulate them to form something that they believe is, quote, useful, suddenly the value of that natural material skyrockets. Think about that. Now, the only place where this isn't true is oil. And the reason white people allow that to occur is because in many instances, the individuals who control these oil-rich countries are seen as kind of honorary white people. Or at least they're considered a higher grade than black and brown people. You know, they pass the paper brown, paper bag test. Now, for those of you who are too young to know what the paper bag test is, basically what the elders used to say was, if white people can hold up a paper bag to your skin and you were lighter than that paper bag, you were considered salvageable as a colored person because you had enough white blood in you to dilute the negative aspects of Africans. No joke. No joke. No joke. Capitalism is a minoritarian dominated economic system. Once you appreciate this, once you grasp this, everything about American history makes sense. Everything. Up to the present day. Because capitalism is all about networks. You hear this everywhere. Oh, yeah, man. Prop up your network. Prop up your network. Prop up your network. It's all about networks. And the networks are always culturally dominated by the persons or person who is closest to the reality, the true north of capitalism. So, a great example of this is sports players. Black people are highly represented in sports play because from a cultural standpoint, I'm talking white cultural standpoint, that's where they want us. They are more comfortable with us there. So they create the atmosphere to draw us and keep us in that network. They do not feel comfortable letting us have our own schools, particularly colleges. And I know we have a bunch of HBCUs, but most of them are underfunded significantly. They don't feel comfortable letting us have that because during Jim Crow, even though they kept us drastically underfunded, we produced some of the greatest minds that this country ever seen. And that was without being funded properly. They know what we are capable of. So they don't want us really having the best schools. They don't want us having our own hospitals. They don't want us to be able to take care of ourselves. They don't want us to have good land to grow our own foods. They'll let Asians have land. They'll let Latinos have land. They'll let Asians have stores. And Latinos have stores, but they don't want black people to have our own possessions, because then we turn the system on its head. Then we turn the system on its head. The system is built for white minority rule, for European minority rule. Europeans, white people, are always the consideration, no matter throughout the world where they live. They are always the primary. If we start to build our own networks, and I'm not saying that we don't do it as black people, but if black people started doing that and was successful, I'm talking about from ground to table or from ground to product that we have in our homes, if we did that on a massive scale, capitalism would cease to exist because the wrong people would be benefiting from it. And thus, the wrong people could influence it culturally. Now, you may say, well, wait a minute. Black people influence the hell out of culture. Yes, but again, I make this claim. the cultural aspects from the black community that have been allowed to, and here I want to say this word and mean it, thrive, because they haven't been allowed to prosper, they've been allowed to thrive, to rip through the world. These are aspects that have been reinterpreted through a white lens and regurgitated, malformed from the minds of white executives or the minds of disaffected and dispossessed black people who focus more on money than on the harm that is actually being done by these cultural parasites or the cultural parasitic concepts. That is the only reason they've been allowed to spread. They are being used as tools for capitalism to expand itself. Only reason. Absolutely only reason. Once you really start understanding and you start conceiving what this actually means, it changes how you look at capitalism. Even the Chinese have brought into the capitalist concept of putting Africans in their place in order to exploit them, just like the Europeans. And yet we're told that communist China is any different than the Western world. No, they aren't. Nope. They're using the same capitalist techniques to build up their country. If you really want to view this in action, look at how a lot of expats or communities around the country of Europeans in non-European countries, often black, brown, or yellow countries, look at how many of those groups are allowed to still have an oversized influence, either in the region that they live or in the country altogether. It almost goes without saying, especially in like South America and some of the Asian countries, the lighter skinned you are, the more precious you are to the community. And in South America, it's even more insidious because in many other countries, the lighter skinned people hold a significant portion of the wealth, control a significant portion of the power, and are the legitimate power base that is often looked at and looked to by the Western world. They are the driving force of the economy. Bolsonaro in Brazil is a perfect example of this, only because he was so blatantly Western. Not only in the way that he talked, in the way that he thought, but the way that he looked. He could not stand the native Brazilians because the West, the Europeans who he idolized, wanted access to the land that they were on. He could not stand the Afro-Brazilians because they were useless, unless they were on his side. They were just criminals and thugs and the rest. He is the quintessential European-minded dictator who hated anybody who wasn't also European-minded. And that concept is very important. That is actually what is what is fueling the conflict in Gaza is the European mindset. Now, many Europeans probably take exception to that. They're like, well, wait a minute. We haven't been this, that, that, and this. Yeah, but y'all started it. So you don't get to run away from it that quickly. You don't get to run away from it that easily. You started it. So the blame goes to you. In the final analyses, the baby boomer generation in this country, and I know I just did a hard shift, they are the largest generation ever produced in this country, and they are the last large white generation of this country. Maybe we need to start questioning if that in some way is driving or has driven them to make the decisions that they've made. In their subconscious of subconscious mind, capitalism is the system that upholds white minority rule throughout the world. And if it is not going to be able to go on because white minority rule is coming to an end throughout the world, then everything must come breaking down and crashing down. The timetable of advanced conservatism suggests that this may in fact be the case. The turn towards democratic neoliberal policies suggests that this in fact may be the case. At the start of the 80s, you had an increasing number of baby boomers messing around with politics. Now, yes, by that time, the silent generation was still the dominant generation. It was the early 90s, supposedly, when the baby boomers took hold of the reins of power in the country. I actually dispute that. I think it was a little bit earlier than that, because by 1980, your earliest baby boomer was already 35 years old. Your latest baby boomer was 15. So I think the numbers are a little bit skewed, but the move towards neoconservatism, the move towards neoliberalism, and do not ever forget the two of them are linked. We don't link them, but they are linked. You cannot have neoliberalism without a neoconservative movement. But the move towards both of those strategies, both of those philosophies, was a move made, and the neoconservatives were very, very upfront about this, to block the threat of progression by a lot of groups, including women, which was seen as a degradation of the cultural foundations of America, and that cultural foundation was purely European. Homosexuals, which was seen as a cultural foundation, a degradation of the cultural foundation of the family, which is at the center of a country or a nation or a group of people. And that foundation was what? European. But most specifically, black people, black African Americans, who were not foundationally, culturally European. So all this talk about ascendance the American descendants of slavery, they don't see you as fundamentally culturally European. You will never be that. You can claim Americanism all you want, but they don't see you as European. They see you as Negroes. And a Negro is a distorted African whose mind has been scooped out and replaced by something foreign. The baby boomer generation, consciously or unconsciously, made political choices to tear down capitalism because they understood that it was not going to be viable. In the stead of a viable capitalism, and again, I just got done explaining why it wasn't going to be viable, in the stead, they've left chaos and the tilt towards authoritarianism. There's a black psychologist, I've mentioned her many times on this podcast, who passed away in early 2016. In an interview she gave some, I think it was a year before she died, she was talking about studying the Germans and the Nazi evolution in Germany. And she said that in applying it to the situation that black people found themselves in the 1950s, which is when she did her studying, she concluded that fascism was in-stage racism. That it was a hyper-systematized dedication to racism and its ultimate conclusion. It put at the head of its system white people. It put at the bottom of its system those who it perceived as being non-white and being unhealthy for the white race to continue its progression. Now, this is a hard statement for me to make about the baby boomer generation, because I'm not saying that they were complicit in this, but to some degree, the destruction of capitalism, the tilt towards authoritarianism in this country, the tilt towards fascism in this country, the systems in place birthed this reality. And the reality was created by the generation. Minoritarian rule is coming to an end. Capitalism is coming to an end. I am sad to say, but I feel this is coming too. The dispossession of generations of Europeans living in former colonies, enjoying the rights and privileges of their former colonizing status, which many of them do enjoy. They don't admit it, but they do enjoy it. That's going to happen. And I believe it's a necessary process in decolonization. But it's going to happen. My hope is it is not violent. That these non-white countries look at the white populations and say, we're going to buy you out. Just like you bought out our people. You get to go back home to Europe. You get to go back home to wherever. But you can't stay here. I hope it's not violent, but I see it coming. Because the problem is this. Too many white people do not want to let the minoritarian concept go. They believe that they are top dogs and that nobody should be top except for them, even though most of the world ain't trying to be that. Before I end, I want to say a brief comment about identity politics. Polls continue to say if Democratic members of Congress, to an extent, not all of them, but some of them, if they talk about issues relating to black people and they're not particularly black, or issues relating to non-white people in general, it turns off white voters. But if they talk about class issues, then white voters tend to respond a little bit better. When they're inclusive with everybody, they don't mention that, you know, black people may need a little bit more help because of things that have happened. As a black man, that analysis pisses me off, but I understand it. I have white friends who are all ears when I'm talking about economic issues. But when I start mentioning that there is going to have to be special care taken for these select groups, except for women, they don't mind me talking about women. But, you know, if I'm talking about black community, if I'm talking about Hispanic community, Native American community, people tend to start getting their eyes glazed over, particularly when I'm talking about economics. Why do you got to bring race into it? My response is that it's all economic. But I think I'm going to change my response. I think I'm going to start asking them, what do they view the primary responsibility of capitalism to be? And then I'm going to ask them, because typically I talk about how the New Deal needs to be reestablished when I'm talking to people about economics, I'm going to ask them if they knew what the position of black people was when it came to many of the New Deal adjustments in the economic sphere. Most of them don't. But I'll tell them, we were not in consideration. In fact, oftentimes, when legislation was passed to restructure the economy, we were left out deliberately. Native Americans were left out deliberately. We'd have to change that to make it right. My point is this. Identity politics, and many of my black elders have said this, and so I'm not saying anything new, but it needs to be said here. Identity politics is only identity politics when you're not talking exclusively about white people. You hear me? Exclusively about white people. Make America Great Again, that movement, I'm sorry, what am I thinking? Counter movement, because it's counter-revolutionary. That is an identitarian counter-movement. It's about white people. It's about white people. Sorry about that. Identity politics is part of the basis of the American experience. The irony is, the two biggest identity or identification characteristics that goes into politics has always been whiteness and richness or money. they've often gone hand in hand. We constantly look at things and say, well, that's a class issue. We don't talk about caste because caste is uncomfortable in the United States. But caste has always been here. That's what race is. Sex is sort of a caste. It's fluid. But it's more culturally based than it is nationally based. But caste and class are both identification characteristics. Sure, one is accumulated. The other one is, well, typically birthed. You know, you're born black or white or red or yellow or brown. But it's still identification. Neoconservatism is all about identitarian politics. On the one hand, whiteness. Sure, they have a few black faces sprinkled in there to make it look like they're not, you know, racist and white supremacist, but whiteness. On the other hand, richness, money. It's a truth nobody seems to want to say. I mean, who was it? Was it Carlyle who did the Gospel of Wealth? That was dedicated to rich people who identified themselves as being uber rich. I mean, what was that book? Richestan? Again, 100% identitarian. That was all I had to say. Thank you guys for listening. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. You can either do so on radio4ALL.net. You can reach out to me on WordPress. Class War Battlefield Podcast on WordPress. CWB Podcast on WordPress. If you like the work that I'm doing here, you can donate to CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast on PayPal, Cash App. You can also reach out to me on Facebook, Class War Battlefield Podcast. I'm getting, you know, I'm starting to build up a presence. So Spotify, Amazon, come and check me out. Come and check me out. Hope y'all enjoyed this one. Big up to Dr. Obita Shaka. Big up to Black Power Media. Big up to Karen Hunter. In Class with Carr. Went to hit that note a little bit too hard, man. Caught my throat off guard. Big up to Professional Left Podcast, the best podcast you should be listening to, y'all. And no, I don't get paid to say that. I really like their podcast. Big up to Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. There's a lot, man. There's a lot. Big up to Armageddon Update, Christopher Titus. There's a lot. There is a lot. If you want a complete list of really good resources, go to my WordPress site and click the link. All right, y'all. Until the next one, I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.